From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. As the world grows warmer and oceans rise, sustainability and the politics of consumption become increasingly critical. We start this episode by taking to the seas, examining how the seafood we eat and the choices we've made and continue to make factor into the big picture. First, we head to Australia, where bushfires and climate change are making headlines, and where a young chef is putting every part of the day's catch to use.
Why is it that we continue to wash a fish when it comes out of the water? It's a backward system that shortens the shelf life dramatically, and it doesn't allow us to celebrate secondary species of fish. It doesn't allow us to work with the offal. We're only using 50%, and if you're a small business like I am, then 50% going in the bin just doesn't add up.
Josh Nyland is an Aussie wonderkind who has captured the attention of chefs everywhere with his fascinating approach to fish. He calls it fin to fin. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here. What you do, your new book called The Whole Fish Cookbook, is truly unique.
Yeah, it's a different approach.
A different approach. One of the most gobsmacking moments of going through this book is when you come to the double picture,
yeah,
of a fish completely broken down. Hmm. So normally I think that would look like 4 to 6 pieces.
Sure.
And yours, it's 31 pieces.
Yeah.
So I think let's start there, that you take, you don't have to go through every one, but when you're talking now about not wasting any part of the fish, you're talking about the cataracts of the eyes,
yeah,
the lenses of the eyes. You're talking about every part.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the only two things that go in the bin when I process a fish are the gills and the gallbladder. And those two are the ones that I see as being, you know, completely not delicious and too texturally challenging, but mainly they're just bitter and acidic and horrible, basically. But everything else from blood, stomach, liver, spleen, hearts, eyes, you know, fish sperm, roe, scales, heads, you know, you name it. It was done in that way to be very, you know, shocking, you know what I mean? I was doing it to represent a poster that I hope to see around the world in fish restaurants, fish mongers, because, you know, when you go into a butchery, then you see a cow on the wall or a pig on the wall and you can articulate the cuts. And I feel like we hadn't seen that yet for fish. So, yeah.
So aside from that, just usage of the whole fish, there's an exhaustive list of factors that you consider when you approach fish cookery. And could you take us through some of them and tell us why they're so critical for success?
I mean, to go right to the beginning of capture, you look at a fish in the water, and when you're trying to catch a fish, obviously the fish is trying to swim away. And so in doing so, it generates so much lactic acid in the actual fish muscle. Eventually the fish runs out of oxygen, it comes up. The best thing that you can do at that point to have a great outcome is to brain spike the fish as ikijime method, which is a Japanese method. By doing that and then cutting the gill and bleeding the fish from the gill, then putting it into a saltwater ice slurry to get to the temperature of the fish down. By doing all of that, you remove the lactic acid from the muscle of the fish. You take the blood out of the fish so it doesn't return to the muscle, and you end up with a fish, you know, that already has every chance of having a longer shelf life than it did. If that doesn't happen and you allow a fish just to die and the temperature doesn't come down, what happens is the lactic acid sits in the muscle of the fish and it almost acts like reverse ceviche, in the sense that if you squeeze lime over the outside of a fish or any kind of acid, you watch it pretty much transform in front of your eyes and it goes milky and cooked. The same thing's happening where lactic acid is eating the muscle in the fish, and it's only when you take the fillet off that you actually see the damage and you see a fish that already looks cooked. And if you put it into a fry pan and try and cook it, oftentimes you'll see it weeping out the muscle and it starts spitting everywhere. And that's a huge issue. The other big problem is this fascination that we have around washing a fish once it comes out of the water. By doing this, a fish is porous. It's got porous scales on the outside of it, and it takes on water like a sponge. What meat butchery in the world have you ever walked into and seen them break down a cow and then take a strip loin off the carcass and then dip that in water in front of them or run it under a tap and then cut a steak from it, dip it under water again, and then put it on ice and try to serve it? It's not a consideration. I've never seen that in my life. If that was the case, maybe there would be something called beefy beef, because we continue to refer to fish as fishy fish.
Fishy fish.
And what that is organic compounds in the fish called trimethylamine oxide. That's once a fish dies. Once that trimethylamine oxide starts breaking down, it converts into ammonia. And ammonia is what fishy fish is. And the only way to offset ammonia is through using acidic ingredients. Hence why we've got a repertoire of cooking now that relies on acidic-based sources and a gesture of half of lemon on a plate. So through good handling and great storage and the things that I'm talking about in the book, we can see a shelf life of a fish go from 4 days to up to 4 weeks at very least.
Can this happen at home where the refrigeration is quite different? The refrigerators are smaller and they're opened and closed many times.
Yeah, I mean, the tests that I've done so far suggest using the crisper of your fridge because it's kind of internalized to its own temperature, so to speak, and the opening and closing isn't as affected as much because it's its own box. The main issue, I feel, is the water, and to remove the water and still use standardized refrigeration, we'll see the storage potential go from 3 to 4 days up to 7 to 8. But there's still this thing in people's minds about if you go down to the market or you go to the shop and you get your fish, then you will always have that fish for dinner that night. There's no thinking that I'll buy my fish on Tuesday and we'll serve it on Saturday night.
No, that would kind of, I think people would be horrified to...
Correct. Serve old fish.
Right.
Whereas come to the restaurant and my old fish gets sold before my fresh fish, and there's a demand to eat fish guts and old fish as opposed to the fillets and the fresh ones.
Okay, so let's not call it old fish. Let's call
That's
it
right, just
aged,
to be funny.
Aged yeah. fish. And give us a sense of what happens to the fish.
Yeah.
So you're also not, it's not on ice.
Correct.
Is it in a perforated pan?
So to take you through, when a fish comes through the door at Fish Butchery, which is our retail space, we cut the scales off a fish instead of using a bear trap on a stick, which I like to call it, which, you know, is really aggressive. And when you cut the scale off, you cut the membrane off, which holds the scale. And that membrane has the potential of holding moisture. So we completely kind of remove moisture from the outside. We take the organs out, we separate everything down. Then we put the hook in the tail, we hang it in the cool room, we leave it on the bone. And then what we notice is over time, in this cold storage, which doesn't have any fan in there, it's just a temperature that sits around 0 degrees, we notice that the glutamates in the fish activate and make the fish more savory and more delicious.
So let's talk about cooking.
Yeah, please.
How can we incorporate some of the offal of the fish into dishes? Or are we incorporating them, or are we looking at them as separate products?
Depending on the significance of the sized fish that you're playing with, if you're looking at something like a John Dory or sometimes snappers as well, like those standard fish that we see so frequently in markets, you should be looking at them as singular items. Like John Dory, for me, like at times they can have a liver inside them that's 20% of the fish's weight, which is just extraordinary. And I mean, to cut that out, it's almost like looking at a large duck liver. It's incredible. And so when you have that in front of you, this is where the fish's meat conversation comes in. And if it's daunting to look at a fish's liver, anything that you can do to a duck liver, you can achieve with a fish liver. So we've made things like pâtés and things like that. But a great way of incorporating it into like a domestic setting would be to pan fry it by dusting it with a little bit of flour and then putting it on a piece of toast and just having liver on toast. It's absolutely delicious. And the quality points for fish organs are the same as the quality points for a great piece of fish. use all your senses, smelling and touch and, you know, feel. You'll know if it's a good piece. The eyeballs of the fish seem to be, for me, the most confrontational place to begin when we kind of came up with it. You know, cultures all around the world have celebrated the whole fish for centuries. I'm not the first person to think about consuming everything rather than just the fillet, but I feel like the dishes that we know from those other cultures don't translate very well into a Western kind of palate, like it doesn't translate to the average American. So I set out to make a prawn cracker, but use eyeballs instead of the shellfish that would have gone into it.
So shrimp cracker, that puffy,
yeah,
that
puffy,
great puffy thing,
that's right,
that we love to eat.
The top three, the deep fried, crunchy, salty. And so you can win people over very quickly when you say those three things. And the same, like the fish sperm, the other extremely challenging, both texturally and also just creatively for me, it was like, it's so difficult because it's such a strange part of the fish. And so we ended up choosing to make a mortadella sausage with it. So by taking the idea of mortadella and then applying, you know, that part of the fish into it, we ended up having this great sausage. And what we did was we used the fish liver pate, the fish sperm mortadella, and then we put the two together and made a banh mi sandwich.
Amazing. I mean, the book is truly groundbreaking. And I can't wait to see how your ideas are going to populate their way through Los Angeles kitchens.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Oh, I'm sure it's going to happen. Well, thank you so much.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
That's Josh Nyland, chef owner of St. Peter, a fish restaurant in Sydney. The Whole Fish Cookbook approaches seafood through a sustainable lens. Stay close. I've got more good food coming up.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. You know what omega-3s are. They're those fatty acids found in walnuts and oily fish like anchovies. They're supposed to make your heart stronger, your brain sharper, and they're now a multi-billion dollar supplement industry.
I can't help but wonder, what would the ocean look like if there was an additional 20 to 25 million metric tons of fish in the sea?
That's best-selling author Paul Greenberg. He spent a year eating an all-fish diet while investigating the history of our obsession with omega-3s. His discoveries are in a great book called The Omega Principle.
I was looking for a way to talk about a whole set of creatures that we don't really pay much attention to, creatures like anchovies and herring, but also plankton, also seaweeds, all these kinds of things that are at the very bottom of the marine food web. I'm sort of known for this book called Four Fish, and when I thought about doing a book that would have krill, algae, seaweed, and anchovies on the cover, I was thinking I could call it Four Little Things, or I could find what was common to them all. And what turns out to be common to them all is omega-3 fatty acids. Everyone in the United States, I think at this point, has heard of the omega-3 supplement. Many millions of Americans take them on a regular basis. So it's really, you know, through self-interest, I think, that we become interested in the rest of the world and the rest of the ocean. So I decided to use this sort of amber-colored pill as the lens through which I would show people the very bottom rungs of the way the ocean works.
Do you take omega-3 supplements?
I do not. I eat quite a bit of fish. I mean, I did for 1 year during the research for this book, I did eat fish pretty much every single meal for a year. And I actually went to this company called Omega Quant and had my finger pricked, or they sent me a test. I pricked my finger and I tested the omega-3 levels in my blood after I had eaten fish for a year. And I also tested all the different metrics that are associated with omega-3s, cholesterol and triglycerides and stuff like that. But no, generally, I'm not a pill taker. I'm not a supplement taker. I wanted to try and do the work kind of in a way outside of the realm of supplements. And I mean, I certainly talked to many supplement manufacturers. I talked to a lot of people who took them on a regular basis. I went deep into the way supplements are marketed to people. I went to the to the summit of the Global Organization for EPA and DHA Omega-3s at the Ritz-Carlton in the Canary Islands. I did everything but take supplements, if you see what I'm saying.
So I'm curious, what did that little finger prick reveal after a year of eating fish?
Well, it revealed that I had blood of a sort of Japanese person or maybe a Mediterranean person, a pre-introduction of industrial food. So I had levels of 10.5% of my blood lipids were omega-3 fatty acids. And that, according to OmegaQuant anyway, is the desirable, well into the desirable range. Many Americans, their omega-3 levels are below 5%. And one of the problems with this book and what were the difficulties of this book was trying to understand what is a real study and what isn't a real study. So everything, or not everything, a lot of things associated with omega-3s tends to focus on what are called association studies. So in other words, we seem to see these high omega-3 levels in certain people, and those people seem to have lower levels of cardiovascular disease. So there's an association, there's a correlation, but there's not a causation. And what I always like to use as the example is that, you know, the worst example of an association study would be, say, somebody who says, I live in a White House, the president lives in the White House, therefore, I am the president. So, but it doesn't work that way. Omega-3 levels in your blood are high. You have low rate of cardiovascular disease. Did the omega-3s cause that, or was it some other thing that was generally associated with your lifestyle that also included omega-3s? That's really the question that lays at the bottom of a lot of the debates about whether omega-3s in supplement form work or not.
So let's start at the beginning of the book and of where these things come from, the predator-prey split.
Yeah. People often think that omega-3s are made by fish. But in fact, omega-3s are made largely by plankton, by phytoplankton, photosynthetic plankton. And they are part of what are called thylakoid membranes that are sort of the frame around a photovoltaic cell in a photosynthetic piece of algae. So that's what they were used for primarily. The way other life forms get omega-3s into their body is primarily by eating things that have omega-3s in their body. So you have little fish that will eat plankton and they will bioaccumulate that omega-3s in their blood lipids. And then that in turn gets passed on to the larger fish that eat them. And then eventually we get them by eating the fish. There's a little bit more subtlety in the book. Like, the book goes very deep into early paleo history. And there's kind of an interesting split where in early plankton, one half of the tree goes in the direction of photosynthesis and, you know, things that grow, that create their own energy from the sun. But the other direction goes in the direction of predatory plankton. And what's interesting to see is that whereas the omega-3 in the photosynthetic plankton is used really pretty much as part of photosynthesis, in the more predatory plankton, it immediately gets incorporated into sensory things, into sensing light, for example. And in fact, there are some early forms of plankton that have this very early form of an eye that will help them perceive movement in front of them. And it turns out that that early eye is high in omega-3 fatty acids. So it's there in photosynthesis, but it's also there in perception. So to me, that makes this kind of magical mix that we nonfiction writers are always looking for.
So one of the things that's fascinating about this whole story, well, some people might say there's two stories. There's the human health and development story, and there's the ecological web story. But of course, really, it's both one story. So this whole idea of way back, way, way, way back, the idea that the plankton was actually clearing the atmosphere of carbon, allowing oxygen to flourish.
Yep.
And so now we're sort of at the back end of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had this sort of funny realization that, you know, early Earth, we know, had very high levels of CO2. When photosynthetic phytoplankton started processing that and turning it into oxygen, they actually cooled the planet, and they actually made the planet less hospitable to them because they evolved in this very warm, carbon-rich environment. And so other plankton had to evolve to kind of enter that niche. What's interesting now, as we burn billions and billions and billions of tons of carbon and put it back into the atmosphere, that we're actually recreating the ancient atmosphere that those original plankton destroyed. So in other words, you know, you could say that, oh, humans were destroying the Earth that we grew up in. Or you could say, weirdly, that we're part of some giant planktonic cycle. And as we release all this carbon that the plankton stored, we're going to create a boom in those plankton. So, you know, it depends how you want to look at the world. Do you want to look at it through the end of the telescope that's plankton? Or do you want to look at it through the end of the telescope that's humans?
So now we get to the part of where we find something that we think is going to be good for us, and we decide we're going to go after it and use it. You say that no one has ever truly cared about the sea. It's been treated as a mine from which wealth is taken and never returned.
That's true. I mean, we're at the dawn of two possible moments, one good and one terrible. The terrible moment is when we sort of head forever in the direction of destroying and plundering the ocean. The good direction is that we are starting to see the error of our ways and that we are starting to understand what it means to do sustainable fisheries management. But in the case of the omega-3, what we're doing in order to get that onto our plates or into our pills is we're primarily targeting these little fish. They are of the taxonomic order Clupeidae, Clupeids one calls them, but these are the sardines, the anchovies, the herring. These little silvery fish are these keystone species. And sorry if I have to back up a little bit to explain some biology, but basically the way the ocean works is the sun shines upon the ocean, phytoplankton transform that solar energy into material energy, fish eat the plankton, and then we eat the fish. If there are none of these little fish in between the plankton and us, or in between the plankton and bigger fish, then that solar energy just gets trapped. It never has a way to move into greater and greater complexity. So because these little fish, these anchovies, these sardines, these herring, because they bioaccumulate and concentrate omega-3s, we've been targeting them not only for supplements, but also for animal feed, because turns out they have a lot of nutrients that things like chickens and pigs and now more and more salmon need. When we remove those critical clupeids from the middle of the food chain, we truncate the upper ends of the bigger fish. So I think we have to be extremely careful when we target those fish. So the companies that go after these little fish, the entire industry is called the reduction industry. And since I've come out with this book, I've certainly seen letters from the reduction industry saying, you know, the Peruvian anchoveta is totally sustainable. The Atlantic menhaden is totally sustainable. And within their sort of small vision of their own stock of fish, maybe you could say that they know they can catch this many fish and they'll get that many fish the next year. When they look at the management of these little fish, they really just look at what's enough fish left in the water so that the same amount of those little fish will be there next year. They don't look, in my opinion, satisfactorily at the entire ecosystem. So they look at what they're going to take out and what they will need in order to have, you know, humans be able to catch fish. But what about the whales? What about the larger fish, the tuna, the swordfish? What about all those fish that really require those little fish to kind of move along? And when you look at the entirety of the reduction industry, you're talking about 20 to 25 million metric tons of fish taken out of the water every year. That's the equivalent of the human weight of the United States removed from the ocean every single year. And it's about a quarter of all the fish that humans catch. So while every little fishery may have their argument about why this is sustainable, why that's sustainable, as a whole, I can't help but wonder what would the ocean look like if there was an additional 20 to 25 million metric tons of fish in the sea.
It's a lot to take in. Why doesn't a supplement have the same effect as eating a diet rich in omega-3s?
I think because partially, fish offer so many other positives besides omega-3s that the supplement industry likes to look at all the data and just say, no, it's the omega-3s that's doing the work. When we eat land food meat, you know, fatty beef, pork, so forth, we're getting a lot more saturated fat. We're getting a lot more calories, generally speaking. We're getting fewer omega-3s, and we're getting a package that I think is less healthy for us overall than seafood. You know, Michael Pollan did this very well in his books where he talked about nutritionism. Remember, he talked about that in Defense of Food, that there was this whole phase of modern food development where people stopped talking about food and started talking about, well, how many vitamins does it have and how much protein does it have and so on and so forth. But it turns out we don't really understand food that well. We can't really just boil it down into a set of 15 or 20 different nutrients. There are micronutrients. There are all these different things that are involved when you eat a fish.
Okay, so now I have to ask you, what was the first set of meals you ate that did not involve fish?
Well, you know, prior to the release of The Omega Principle, I was actually also at the same time working on a documentary for Frontline. And one of the kind of conclusive moments of the Frontline was that I went and had my blood tested and so forth after, you know, at the end of the year of eating seafood. And then the producer said to me, well, what do you want to do now? And I was like, I would really like to eat a burger. And so we went down to the Lower East Side, you know, for a beautiful grass-fed burger and a glass of red wine. There is something to, you know, well-produced beef, but I'm trying to wean myself off of it. I'm trying to actually move in the direction of what I concluded in the book, which is that when I talked to different people who had done large meta-analyses of association studies around diet, that generally speaking, it seemed to be that a Mediterranean diet or a Mediterranean diet that was tilted towards fish might be the diet that is going to lead us to the greatest longevity and lowest risk of chronic disease. And I sort of coined a term out of that. I call it the pescatarian diet. So in other words, in a Mediterranean diet, very little animal protein, few meals a week at most. But in the pescatarian, that very few meals a week is coming to you primarily from the ocean, ideally from things like anchovies or sardines or filter-feeding bivalves like mussels and clams and oysters. So that's the pescatarian diet. If anyone wants to offer me a book contract for that, I'm ready to do it because, gosh, I don't want to do another book like this for a little while.
That's Paul Greenberg. We've been discussing his book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. In a minute, we go under the sea to learn about the bizarre sex lives of lobsters. Trust me, you want to hear this. Stay close. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Let's take a moment to consider the lobster. When Trevor Corson published his 2004 book, Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean, he was shocked to see it fly off bookstore shelves. Why did it sell so well? It turns out lobsters' lived experience and their sex lives in particular is much stranger than fiction.
It's a bit graphic. It's surprising as to how it happens, but lobsters talk to each other actually by squirting jets of urine out of their faces at each other. I know that doesn't sound very appetizing.
That is just so horrifying. I don't even know what to do with that information.
But it's actually beautiful because that's how they share these intimate chemical cues that allow them to actually end up having a rather romantic love life.
So the females, they mate and then they have eggs. So what happens when a lobsterman traps a load of lobster and they find females that are loaded with roe?
Right. So the females that have eggs that are extruded onto their tail, where they keep them actually for about 9 months, those are very obvious because when you open up a trap, and I worked on lobster fishing boats for 2 years and became very familiar with this whole procedure. When you open up the trap, the females with eggs are immediately apparent. You pull them out. They've got all these eggs on the bottom of their tail. They're illegal to sell. You can't keep them. So rather than just throw it back, the fishermen have come into the habit of marking that female lobster with eggs with a little notch in one of her tail flippers. And this marks her as a proven breeder. And they throw her back with this notch in her tail with the eggs intact. And she goes on and, you know, the eggs hatch and produce baby lobsters. But if she's picked up again later and still has that notch in her tail, it's still illegal to sell her. So she stays down there. And the idea is that you accumulate that way a population of breeding females who are replenishing the lobster population. It's actually a very, very imaginative and effective conservation technique.
During the time that you were on the boats, what was the largest specimen that you ever came across?
We had at one point a lobster come up. Its claw had gotten stuck in the entrance of the trap. And so its claw alone was larger than a normal dinner plate sized lobster. And it came up hanging off the side of the trap and was enormous. And that one got donated to an aquarium.
Really?
Yep. There are some really big lobsters. There's been some interesting research that's been coming to light about the fact that they have certain enzymes that are very good at keeping their DNA healthy. And as a result, lobsters don't seem to age quite the way most of us do. They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they can live a very long time. We don't have very accurate ways of aging lobsters, but estimates are 70 years, you know, maybe longer. If they're not caught and they reach that maximum size limit, they'd be protected.
You actually, at one point, called the lobster the animal equivalent to a mosquito. What do you mean by that?
The nervous system of lobsters, as far as we can tell so far, seems to be fairly similar to that of a mosquito or a grasshopper. It's a pretty simple, decentralized nervous system. That said, there has been a long debate about whether or not lobsters can feel pain, which, of course, relates directly to us eating them, because lobsters are typically, you know, we have them live in the kitchen, and they're typically boiled live. And there's quite a bit of research happening on this. Perceptions are starting to change. In Europe are robust movements to apply animal welfare laws to crustaceans. It's entirely possible that at some point it might actually become illegal to boil lobsters alive. That's already the case, I believe, in New Zealand and at least one town in Italy.
So how do we humanely kill a lobster in preparation for dinner?
This is a fascinating question, and it we are at a pivot point right now for what's changing with this situation, because think of it, lobster was pretty much the last animal that we would still encounter alive in our kitchen. I mean, in the old days, if you wanted to eat chicken, you would grab a chicken from the chicken coop and kill it and pluck it and eat it. What's happening now is that you're starting to notice live lobster tanks disappearing from grocery stores. And there is a new type of technology. It's called HPP, which stands for hydrostatic pressure processing. And these are gigantic machines. I mean, just huge machines. The typical one is a 16-foot tall device that weighs like 80,000 pounds. And they were originally designed to help the U.S. Army serve better tasting, you know, MRE meals, the ready-to-eat meals for troops, by coming up with a way of removing pathogens through water pressure. And someone found out that you could stick shellfish in these things and it would separate the flesh from the shell in a way that was never possible before. So they're now using these to process lobsters, but they're just dumping in a whole bunch of live lobsters, cranking up the pressure. It does kill them at some point. The whole thing takes several minutes, and the meat separates from the shell, and that can then be extracted and sold as a frozen meat product, just like, you know, like a frozen chicken breast would be. There's no more lobster, no more shell, just the meat. And so right now, lobster's transitioning into this new type of product that can just be, you know, impersonally bought at the supermarket that way. And we don't even know, really, whether it's humane, as far as I know, inside those machines. So I don't know if that solves that problem, but we're losing that connection that at least made us think about what was happening.
So if we are still up for the task of doing the deed ourselves in our kitchen, walk us through the steps of what the best way would be to prepare a lobster for the table if humane killing is part of what we care about.
I personally still see this as an opportunity to remain connected to where the food comes from. And what I do is take a live lobster and I put it in the freezer for 15 or 20 minutes. And the lobsters are cold-blooded. That slows down their metabolism, reduces their response rate. And then and this is a little graphic, but this technique has also been studied by animal welfare experts and considered much more humane than boiling alive. I just flip the lobster upside down. I take a towel and put it over its tail and hold it down. It's pretty groggy at that point. And I just take a very large kitchen knife and I split the whole body from underneath. So the lobster's upside down, and that splits right between the legs, the whole body, as quickly as I can. I mean, it's just a fraction of a second. And that severs as many of these decentralized nerve ganglia as possible all at once, much more so than just sticking a knife in the lobster's so-called head, which, you know, you sometimes see chefs doing. The lobster's dead at that point, and then I just throw it in the pot right away.
Trevor, as always, it's just fascinating and such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great questions. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Trevor Corson is the author of The Secret Life of Lobsters. Let's stay under the sea for a little longer and turn our attention to sea urchin, or uni as it's called in the food world. These sea-dwelling delicacies are harvested in the coastal waters of Santa Barbara and the Channel Islands. And if you've had uni at a restaurant in LA, there's a good chance it was plucked from the ocean floor by Stephanie Mutz. Stephanie is one of the only female urchin divers in the state of California. She joins us from Santa Barbara with a little Urchin 101. So tell us what uni is.
Technically, the uni is the gonads of a sea urchin.
So it's not technically roe.
There's roe contained inside of the female sea urchin, the female uni. So there's roe inside, but technically what you're eating are the gonads.
And so we eat both male and female gonads.
We eat both male and female gonads. I tend not to tell people what it is until they try it.
Because the word is off-putting?
It's a bit off-putting. Ovaries and testicles aren't very appealing, but they're delicious.
So we know sea urchins as these really beautiful, amazing spiny creatures. How do you go about harvesting them?
I dive for them. So I don a wetsuit and fins and a mask, and I dive down with a bag and a rake, and I pick them one at a time off the bottom of the ocean.
And do they just hang out on the bottom? What kind of environments are they generally found in?
They enjoy rocky reef and in the kelp beds. Generally, they eat kelp and they eat a lot of algae, but in reality, they eat everything. I've seen fish hanging out of their mouths. I've seen the other day I saw one with a starfish, but the best food for them is the Macrocystis, the giant kelp.
And given that we actually have a bit of a kelp industry here in California, how are the people who harvest kelp and those of you who dive for uni, what's the balance there?
It's actually a very great balance. The kelp harvesters only take the first couple feet off of the top of the kelp beds, of the kelp strings. And to be honest, when they go through and do some trimmings, quite a bit of that falls down to the ocean floor and essentially feeds the urchins. So and gets them sweeter, gets them fatter. And so it's a bit of a synergistic relationship.
Is there a particular time of year when the urchins, you just use the word sweeter and fatter. So is that a seasonal occurrence?
There tends to be, yes. In Santa Barbara, the best time of year is around August until February, because in February is when a couple of things, there's a lot, you know, there tends to be storms and surge. And it's also there's not a lot of kelp available. And then it also is a time when the sea urchins are spawning. And so what the things that they're spawning are the things that we're eating. So they tend to be a bit skinny around that time. If we leave them there for a bit and let them eat, they will grow back fat and plentiful. Sea urchins are a bit of, they are what they eat. So the more kelp, giant kelp that they're eating, the better quality, the better tasting, the sweeter, the fatter they get.
Describe the texture.
Creamy, custardy.
So good. And the flavor?
It tastes like a sweet ocean. You know, it's got a bit sweet, a bit salty, and that creamy, creamy texture.
So where do you sell and when?
I sell my sea urchins live and whole to restaurants in Santa Barbara and LA. I also, on Saturdays, I go to the Dory Fleet at the Newport Pier. And it's an open fish market, and there's seven of us fishermen there selling selling our catch. And we were there at 5:30 in the morning, and so is half of Orange County.
How long does fresh live uni keep in the refrigerator? Like if we were to get our hands on a whole one from you, how do we store it? What do we do with it?
I tell my customers, you know, when they bring it home, they need to put it in the refrigerator. No ice, no water. Just put it in the refrigerator and, you know, try not to let it sit in any of its juices. And it could stay there for good 3-4 days.
And will it be alive? Like, will it crawl around?
It can for the first day or two.
And is it difficult to crack it open?
It's not difficult to crack open. You can use a cleaver. You can use scissors. You can use the back of two spoons.
And where do you go in?
You look, you crack them open upside down on the, by the mouth. So you look for the teeth and you turn it upside down and you go in from the bottom where the mouth is.
And what do we find when we open it?
When you open up an urchin, the first thing that'll pop out at you is the mouth, the teeth. It's a big cylindrical, white, bony apparatus, and it doesn't taste very good. So I don't encourage trying to eat that. And then you'll see a bunch of seawater and algae that will pour out. And then there's a bunch of, you know, essentially just dark membranes, and you pull all that out and then spoon out the goodness. Besides the mouth, the teeth, you can eat the entire sea urchin, the insides of it. Traditionally, Italians and the French like to just cut a hole in the bottom and take the mouth out, and then just the seawater, the uni, and the innards and everything, and swish it all around and eat it with some bread. It's actually really good. I call it uni juice. It's really good.
So are you constantly learning by this interaction with chefs how to use it?
I'm constantly learning how to use sea urchin. I'm constantly excited about learning. One of my Vietnamese customers taught me this recipe of using some scissors and cutting open the bottom of the sea urchin and cleaning it all out, and then cracking an egg inside and steaming it until the egg is the consistency you like, and then eat the uni and the egg. It is really delicious.
That was Stephanie Mutz, a.k.a. C. Stephanie Fish. To find out where to buy her urchin directly, follow her on Instagram at C, that's S-E-A, Stephanie Fish. When Good Food returns, we take all this delicious seafood to the plate. Gabriela Camara from Mexico City's Contramar is with us next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. 2 decades ago, a sublime experience of ceviche and tostadas on a Zihuatanejo beach inspired Gabriela Camara to open Contramar, which became one of Mexico City's most acclaimed restaurants. In her cookbook, My Mexico City Kitchen, Gabriela shares the recipes that make guests feel as if they're lunching on a beach holiday in one of the busiest and crazy cities on the planet. The introduction to her book is titled Not Your Typical Mexican Girl. And she joins us to explain what that means.
You know, I was born in Mexico. I was born in the north of Mexico in Chihuahua, even though none of my parents were from there. My father is from Mexico City. My mother is from Florence, Italy. So I've always been living in Mexico as a Mexican, but with a little bit of a foreign, I mean, not a little
bit. Je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, I mean, with a foreign background. And then I was raised in a town close to Mexico City called Tepoztlán in Morelos, south of Mexico City. Beautiful town in a valley surrounded by incredible mountains. It has an Aztec pyramid. And we were a family that was not the average family living there full time. Most people would go to Tepoztlán from the city only on weekends, but we lived there full time. And it was
both your parents worked.
Both my parents worked. So I was the only person with a mother who worked, let alone left the town to go to Mexico City to work every day. So we were always sort of the black sheeps in a way, in a very good way.
I was going to say that aside from not fitting in and those feelings, there must have been some freedom to that identity.
So much. And my parents are extremely cool people that really, I think, looked after my brother and me in the best of ways.
You say that you grew up in a hippie house.
Yes, I did. My parents built their first house where I was born, and then my brother was born in Chihuahua with their hands, literally. They made these blocks. They had ferro cement domes that my father built. We had, you know, a solar oven, solar heating water system. Then when we moved to Tepoztlán in Morelos, there's a long rainy season, and then there's a long dry season. So we had like water from the rain season that we collected, or that we still collect. My parents still live in that house.
So your connection to cooking, I know when you were little,
uh-huh,
that a housekeeper who worked for your family taught you how to make tortillas. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have a mom in the kitchen. So were you intrigued by the women who are making food for your family? Did you hang out with them? What was your connection to actually making food?
Since I can remember, I really loved food. And I loved watching adults cooking. And I loved watching my grandmother. My maternal grandmother spent a lot of her time in our house. She would come for the winter.
But so, she was not making
tortillas. Yes. No, she was not.
She was baking.
She was baking beautiful crostatas, and she was making pasta, and she was making, you know,
Italian things.
And growing things in the garden, Italian things that weren't typical of Mexican cooking. But I was also very much in touch with my father's sisters, who were extraordinary cooks. After my grandmother passed away, all her recipes and her food teachings went to my aunts. And I loved being with them. I loved going to their house and just spending the day or the afternoon being with them in the kitchen. And I wanted to learn. So they would really take the time to teach me. And, you know, my grandmother, my Italian grandmother, was not a patient person. She was very much of a perfectionist. You know, she didn't want kids around when she was cooking, but she let me.
So you opened Contramar in Mexico City 21 years ago.
Yes.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yes.
It's such an amazing space because it's huge and it's one room and there's so many voices, and yet it's intimate and feels good. You feel so taken care of there.
I love that you say that. That is a lovely description. That's exactly what I would want you to feel or experience there.
What was the aha moment? What made you decide 21 years ago, as a person who didn't have restaurant experience?
None.
To take on this challenge?
It was really a leap of faith and a total experiment. We were four partners. We were all young. Only one of the four original partners had like cafeteria and sort of small bistro experience as an owner, not even as a cook or as a, you know, front of house person. And we just thought it would be very cool to have the food that we would eat on the beach in the city, because you could find fresh seafood and fish that you couldn't really eat at restaurants. Restaurants that, you know, in the 90s.
They were either very high end, right?
Yes. Or they were food stalls and markets. Or fondas. Contramar was always conceived as an interpretation or a take on Mexican beachside palapas in the center of the city.
Which is just an awesome way to eat. Let's talk about the food.
Yes. So, you know, from the beginning, we had freshly made tortillas, which was something that was not common at all 20 years ago. In Mexico City, you did not find good tortillas. It wasn't easy to find good tortillas. Either refried black beans or whole black beans, a fresh grilled fish, and salsa in a taco.
Really great fresh grilled fish.
Yes.
Really great sauces.
Yes.
Contramar's signature dish probably is the pescado de la talla.
Pescado a la talla, yes.
Yeah.
And that means, a la talla means rubbed with chile sauce.
It's like the Instagram darling of your restaurant.
It is the Instagram darling
because
of my restaurant.
Because one side of it is red and one side of it is green.
Yep. The traditional is red chiles. And I added the green because we wanted it to be appealing for everybody, even for people who didn't eat chile. And we wanted it to be appealing for this very cosmopolitan
audience
that Mexico City has always had.
So I'm just going to throw out of the stuff that I put bookmarks in that I'm going to be making. So you have in there a milanesa torta.
Yes.
But it has chilaquiles in it.
Yes.
Okay. So I think this is a genius idea.
Which was not my idea. It's something that happens. It's something that they make. There's a very, very popular food stall. It's a table on a corner in the Condesa neighborhood in Mexico City, very close to where I live. And these ladies, these sisters and their mother, make this amazing torta with chicken milanese and chilaquiles. And it is so good.
So, you know, we of course have all kinds of grocery stores here. And in the Mexican grocery stores in this time of year, actually, you start to see verdolagas, purslane.
Yes. Yes.
So I know that a lot of Los Angeles cooks look at this vegetable and they have no idea what to do with it. Can you describe what it is and then tell us how you serve it?
Well, purslane is actually a succulent. It grows everywhere. It's sort of a weed.
It is a weed, yeah.
Yes. And so as succulents are, it's savory and it holds water in the thick leaves. So it has a bite to it, and it's also very acidic and savory. I love it raw in salads. I love it as a topping for tostadas or as a topping for a taco, but I also love it cooked. And one of my favorite Mexican recipes is pork ribs in salsa verde with verdolagas. And I make a version of that with fish at Contramar.
That was Gabriela Cámara. She shares the recipes from her beloved Contramar in her book, My Mexico City Kitchen. If you travel north to the Pacific Northwest, you'll find a different seafood culture. Seattle chef Renee Erickson has several nautically named restaurants that remind us that in her hometown, it's as much about miroir as it is about terroir. Back in 2014, I spoke to her about her book, A Boat, A Whale, and a Walrus. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's so great to have you here. And I feel like so many of us who live in Southern California who have never experienced your places sort of need to have a little Renee 101. So let's start with your dad and just fishing and the boat. You have an older brother.
I do, Ryan, yes.
And he got to do a lot of stuff with your dad.
It's true. You know, I'm the younger sister. We spent our summers on the Tulalip Indian Reservation, which is about 40 minutes north of Seattle. And we have a cabin. It's a shack, basically, but it was, you know, a place where we could go and spend our summers. And, you know, my fishing happens, you know, in the early morning hours, and my dad would get up and kind of quietly take my brother and go fishing. And, you know, like once I was probably like 8 or 9, I started to get really competitive or just like wanting to do everything that my older brother did. And so I eventually convinced them to take me out all the time, but it took a while where I would get up and kind of, you know, pout down to the beach and drag our little boat out, and I would sit on the dock out on the water and fish for basically dogfish is what I would catch, and I would, you know, try to just fish without any success. But eventually I was allowed on the boat and spent a lot of time then fishing with my father and brother, and we did a lot of crabbing, and it was, you know, it's still my favorite thing to do.
So I'm just fascinated by the fact that you grew up with an ease around fish that only comes if you are actually a fisher person. And then you also had this very French experience, which a lot of it revolves around very, very simple seafood that looks like it's just been pulled out of the sea. So could you talk a little bit about how those two experiences come together in your food?
In traveling, I definitely felt really at home in you know, in Paris for sure, but even more so in Normandy and Brittany, where I've spent a lot of time traveling. I think for many reasons, it feels very similar to the Northwest, and a lot of that is the culture around seafood and oyster farming and the weather and the apples and all the things that are very Northwest as well. So it became different enough, and I felt really inspired by the influences that are in Normandy and Brittany in regards to cooking, and it just felt like a really, you know, it's just such a beautiful place to go, and I feel like I'm learning things that are different enough from what my experiences are in Seattle and you know, just being constantly inspired. And Normandy's a place that I really go to have that experience.
So let's take it to the plate. Manila clams, which is something that here on the West Coast, all of us get to sort of gorge on if we wish.
Mm-hmm.
Share with us a sort of slightly French way that you love to make them.
Well, I mean, the one that's in the book is with sorrel, which is a very common vegetable in France, but not so common here. And so that's something I think, you know, in cooking, especially cooking seafood, I think the element of acidity, lemons, and even vinegars are something that I really like with the richness of seafood. And in the dish that's in the book, and one of my favorites, it would be with whether it's bacon or any kind of smoked pork product with like a shallot or an onion. And oftentimes, you know, we'll cook with just real simple white wine. I really like cooking sherry with sherry or vermouth as well as the liquid to steam the clams in. And something that is definitely taken from the Normandy cuisine is adding at the end, once the clams are all cooked and you're ready to eat, putting in a big generous scoop of crème fraîche, stirring that in, and then you're ready. I think the sorrel element is something that, you know, like instead of just having lemon juice or something, it adds this real bright and then also green quality to the clam dish as well, which is something that I think there's a really great relationship with, you know, like things like seaweed or sea beans and things like that that have that real salty, briny flavor to go with the clams.
Thank you so much, Renee.
Thank you for having me.
That was Renee Erickson talking about her book, A Boat, a Whale, and a Walrus, Menus and Stories. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and John Meek. I'm Evan Kleinman. Thank you so much to everyone who donated to KCRW during our drive to the future. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. Eat well, be merry, and I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.